this whole iPhone-y, iClone, whatever we're calling it, design, since we all seem to have kind of agreed that something kind of like an iPhone, you know, something kind of like an iPhone is going to be really cool.
Has anyone seen, apart from me, the Prada recently announced they're going to be making it, like a designer phone that looks a lot like the iPhone and has a touchscreen interface as well?
That's an LG
phone. That they're Prada phone.
LG
I saw that, yeah. It's supposedly not quite as good.
Okay, cool. Well, I mean, yeah, pretty much.
Software-wise, probably.
Yeah. Although, I told Matt that Apple sent a cease and desist note to someone who built a Windows Mobile sort of iPhone-looking phone.
Oh, skin. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, that's not exactly so revolutionary at the most
definitely.
Windows Mobile devices already have every one of these features, essentially.
Well, I think that the iPhone, the one thing that you can say about Apple is that they do the integration fairly nicely. So if you're doing the four or five things that Apple thinks that you want to do with their device, it's set up so the experience is nice.
As long as you don't want to do anything else.
Right, as long as you don't want to do anything else. And
nothing breaks.
Right.
Oh, yeah, tell me about it.
And as long as you don't try to put your laptop to sleep, but... right, and that's where I think this group is going to be, you know, most influential, because I think we're all interested in building cool devices, and I'm interested in building a cool device with like a reference design and some reference software, and just tell people just go for it, just take it and do whatever the heck you want to do with it, which is certainly not the model. Certainly not Apple's model.
I mean, what you were talking about earlier, one of the reasons I came to Destructibles and one of the reasons I came to this group is that the mobile phone is just a classic example of why network neutrality is important.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. Like, if you look at the innovation of the internet and what happened there versus what's happened in the mobile space, a huge amount of that can be traced back to the fact that you just can't do things on your own.
Right.
If you had open mobile networks, you would have seen such proliferation of devices versus what you have now.
Well, right, and I think that the Serge Patel and Deva Seethram, the guys that were behind the initiation of TuxPhone, you know, I talked to them at great length, and what they said the reason they were most interested in that started them thinking about it was that they were working on an RFID technology solution at a little small company doing this, and it was time to go talk to the cell phone companies about integrating their RFID stuff with the cell phone. And the response from the cell phone company was, okay, pay us $10,000 to start talking to us. And it's the reason that Craig and I have talked about another company, which is that they want to weed out anybody who is not already at a certain level, or either for reasons of support, they don't want to support the individual innovator, or for whatever other reasons. So, and that's
a conversation with MBA, a mobile, whatever it's called, mobile virtual network
enabler.
Well, no. So they're not. They help you become an MVNO. They're an enabler as opposed to an operator.
They're like the
Basically, they said that just to get going, you're basically going to have to spend about $250,000 to build enough phones that the phone company will be interested in talking. Then you have to register with them, and just basically to set up the infrastructure to deal with the cellular company like that.
I'm going to pass this around. This is a thing on the MVNO summit coming up. So if you don't know anything about them, check it out. But I would think that all of that has to do with just getting them in there, getting on, piggybacking on the infrastructure of the carrier. That's all about piggybacking. It has nothing to do with the handset. Other than
no, it's that they'll basically want you to, so the context that I was talking about it in was Gumstix basically creating a cellular device and being able to sell it with with a data plan.
Okay.
And so in order to set that up, in order to set up a device and be able to sell SIM cards that are tied to the IMEI number and registered on the network, you have to basically lay out about $250,000 to get into that game.
What network was this?
That was the cheapest, and I think it was Sprint, because Sprint is desperately trying to get more data.
Well, right, they've got a lot of, Sprint has a lot of.
So Sprint, from what he said, Sprint is tries to go out of their way to be more helpful because they're trying to grow their data business. Mm-hmm. And the other operators, basically, even if you put $250,000 on the table,
Can you just tell us what the top three cost categories were for the $250,000?
It was about $60,000 to $70,000 in just kind of registration fees and, you know, licensing, getting them to do compatibility testing for their network and your device and all that. Even if you were using a pre-approved module to do the communication.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was basically integration costs to integrate your IT systems with their back end stuff to be able to do the registering with the SIM cards and IMEI numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of it was actually also charges that basically the MVNE was going to charge in order to use their billing software. Yeah.
That's not a barrier. If you
unless you only want like 100 devices.
Sure, but it's what you were trying to do is start basically an open source network. It's theoretically possible that you can get investment enough to.
Yeah. Right. I mean, we could go talk to Gilmore and, you know, the usual suspects of.
There are a lot of people with enough money that isn't really a huge barrier.
Right. And also, I think that there may be some interest in kind of the mid-tier private label space. I've been talking to some of the private label.
Trucking's a great option.
Yeah.
Or, but they've been talking a lot of trucking.
Walgreens is interested in having their own handsets. Who knew?
The other thing was, so the $250,000, yes, I agree, there are people who can come up with that, or 150 or whatever you need to, even if it's not possible, you can come up with the money, that's not a problem. It was going to be 18 months to basically get it up and running.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Wow. I need to start now.
Exactly. Yeah. And so basically in the end, what we decided to do is just kind of build it, buy a bunch of SIM cards, not necessarily tell them about it, and then they come to us and say, you're being naughty, you say, oops, sorry, and
we'll
do it again.
Are you being naughty? Do the modules come with their own IMEIs?
They do.
So that's all you need. You really don't need other.
So as long as you're doing GSM, you can basically, what you can do is you can just get a bunch of SIM cards and say, okay, here's the SIM card, plug it into the thing. And,
Let
me ask everyone here a question. Maybe you know this. I've never quite understood. Singular and T-Mobile are both GSM providers.
Right.
There's a vast difference in the coverage network between the two. Particularly, here, Singular is a great service.
Are you using different phones? Mm-hmm. Are you using the same phone?
But just like I said, we had a company map, and they showed like the T-Mobile map versus Singular.
Well, at least in my area, they basically call you the same towers.
We had a base station that was Singular that now has got a T-Mobile label on it.
Right.
And it's older technology, so what was it, 900 or anything?
Yeah, because I think it was 2001 or 2000 when T-Mobile or VoiceStream turned into T-Mobile, and they made a deal with Singular to use the old AT&T towers west of the Mississippi or something, or west of the Rockies. And so I certainly know that east of the Rockies or east of the Mississippi or something like that, the networks had always been distinct. But you know, as they turned from being a regional player to a national player, they made this deal where they would use the same towers that originally.
I think originally we have in the same building, we've got Singular coverage and T-Mobile doesn't work.
Right, right.
That's what we have here too.
But what it was is this old Ericsson gear years ago, the big Ericsson gear, and I think it was the original stuff. and that was all hooked to a T1 there, and then they came in again, and then they put a smaller aerial on the roof, which I think was the higher frequency gear.
Oh, okay.
And then they
labeled it, upgrading to 1900.
Yeah, so they've upgraded. Single had gone to 1900, and then sold off the 850 or 900 to T-Mobile.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because
they sell the tower, and we'll give the combination lock number to the T-Mobile tech guy to get
in there
and fix it.
No, it's got T-Mobile label on it now, because it's interesting. The office building where I got my office, the landlord makes more out of because he's on a hill where there's no coverage, right?
Okay.
So his office building is on a hill out in Concord. Oh. And it's a really bad blind spot. I don't know whether you know Nation Valley Road.
Yeah.
So it's a really bad blind spot for the cell operators. So he's making a killing and renting out all these rooms with equipment in them and all these areas on the roof.
They're giving cancer discounts to human tenants.
Well, I don't think he worries about that.
If you go across the UK, all the little old churches which are on the high points where you can see them, they have heralds inside the roof, and it's what's paying the church fund now.
The church bells have now been replaced by the church stuff.
Well, the bells are still there, but hiding in the roof, there's some aerials. It's kind of kept the hip architecture going. The steeple's about to fall down, stick an arrow in it.
Yeah. So I guess I think that the future is building fewer of the same devices and selling it to more, adding more value-added services on top of it and pushing it down little tiny niches. And this, is not something that I think that the carriers, it's not the model that the carriers have. I mean, the long tail model. I think that there's, now that it has a name, now that Anderson wrote that book, and it has a name, then people can start talking about it in the corridors of power at the carriers and in different corporations. So I'm sure we'll start seeing people think about that. But what I would love to do is I'd love to just have evolve a set of tools and a toolkit that people can just mix and match some of the stuff for personal projects or even for commercial projects. I have no, unlike some people I know and that are radical GNU supporters who are opposed to commercial use of software. I have no problem with people making money off of stuff that I do as long as I get it. Maybe people point to me and say that's the guy who did some of this stuff. I'm a big fan of the BSD license. It's the least restrictive from a corporate perspective. And I also believe that, whereas GNU tries to force you to put your changes back, resubmit your changes, I think that, that there might actually be market forces that would encourage people to give their changes back, even if they were not required to by the license. Because anybody who's ever had to deal with a product that forked, or an open source project that's forked, and or some patch that you've created and didn't get accepted into the main fork, it's oftentimes a pain in the ass to maintain your changes distinct of the main changes.
How much sharing is there across the various projects that are out there? So if we look at the Green Phone and the OpenMoCo and Tux Phone, can we just say, oh, that looks nice, and take it from the OpenMoCo and they've got some application and run it on a Green Phone or something ourselves? Is there anything to stop us doing that?
I don't know enough about the OpenMoCo, to be perfectly honest. Now, at the low level, I know that both the Green Phone and the OpenMoCo are using GSM modules that are.
I'm thinking more about the application.
Okay, the application.
If you're on a calendaring application and somebody's written one, that's sized for mobile, that's talking to an X display, because that's what it's running.
Green Phone's running QT.
Your application's just QT. It's
Yeah. So, but if you want to run it on a different phone that isn't Qt, how much for it?
Qt library.
Yeah, you have to port it.
I mean, but, in theory, there's nothing to stop it. So if it's all open source, you can just change it and move it or whatever. I'm just thinking, how hard is it in practice?
I think.
Or is every open source project going to write its own set of applications?
That's one of the things that kind of made me really sad about some of the stuff that's going on at Palm Source, is that Palm Source looks at, you know, the mobile Linux market, and you know they say, oh great, it's like we can use Linux to build, you know, a platform to put our own apps on our own phone. So they're not interested in doing something a little bit more like, you know, Microsoft, you know, heaven forbid I should say something nice about Wince, but when you're a Wince customer and you buy Wince, you get the complete application stack if you want it, assuming you bought the $12 per license. But it does sort of seem like all of the people that I know that are doing complete phones, they're not sure where the value is in that stack. So they're not going to give up any bit of it until they figure that out. So it may be that a year from now, Access will actually have, you know, a version of their browser that will work on anything that we might build, or a version of their PIM apps.
What is the browser that comes with the Qt or Firefox? Is there a web browser in there?
Well, the Qt, it's a Safari. I mean, it's an old web kit.
Conquer,
that's right. Yeah.
It's Opera run on it as well?
I wouldn't be surprised if it does. I haven't seen Opera run on the green phone, but you know, I don't really have one, so I only saw it working for a couple hours.
Somebody had one. There was a Mobile Monday talk, and it was one of the guys that comes to this one, and he actually got one.
Cool.
Christmas. He badgered them, and they said, "Yeah, okay, we're finally they'll ship one." They got it between Christmas and the New Year.
Is the guy with the long hair and the white glasses?
I think I don't know.
It was Jamie.
He was the guy, one of the guys that was organizing Mobile Monday. AOL.
Okay.
A few weeks ago, there was a talk there about the platform, the fact that there's like a 700 porting platforms, and it was about that.
Okay.
So it's kind of interesting. I forgot his name. I thought I might see him here waving it around.
Yeah, I was actually kind of hoping to see.
Is anyone here talking to the OpenMoco people?
I've talked to him a little bit, and one of the guys who posted on the list was, he seemed to speak authoritatively about OpenMoco.
Yeah, but they said they were sending it out to developers. That's their timescale. So
okay.
I was assuming that somewhere in the club ended up getting one.
Yeah, my biggest problem.
Poke at it and see if it looks any good.
My biggest problem with both GreenFone and the OpenMoco phone are that they're both fixed designs, and that they're also both based on kind of closed hardware. Because
yeah.
I think that to a large degree, when you talk about application in the mobile space, you're also talking about hardware. You know, unlike, you know, desktop PCs, where an application is really only just software. So I mean, there are a number of cool applications I might think that I might want to work on in the mobile space, but it's going to require hardware modifications. To
you want an accelerometer in there or something?
Yeah, I want the accelerometer in there. I want a Zigbee interface so I can actually, you know, do other types of communication, other types of devices, because I'm not getting a Bluetooth stack. And, you know, I don't think we're going to get a Bluetooth stack in a PIC-based, you know, scale, weight, you know, weight scale or blood pressure monitor or blood glucose monitor or anything like that. So, you know, I want Zigbee in there. And, you know, unfortunately there are no Zigbee SD card you know, devices.
There's
and
really Zigbee anything.
Yeah, there's really no Zigbee.
Yeah.
There's some Zigbee ICs.
Interns at a Zigbee project about a year ago I sat for a presentation on, and they had great fun trying to make anything work.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, Zigbee seems to be Bluetooth light and
low power Bluetooth, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, right. It's like Bluetooth minus minus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It can't go farther, actually.
Yeah, it's
got
faster.
It's a lot faster.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's considerably lower power, I think, is the...
Doesn't set up a mesh, too?
I think there
is some kind of mesh networking thing that can do, but you can do a mesh in Bluetooth if you're really hard.
Well, right, and that's just it, is that in
I think the main problem and the reason that there isn't a whole lot of Zigbee hardware is because it's such a broad, it's a very big standard that covers lots of stuff.
Right, same as Bluetooth.
I think it's even broader than Bluetooth, though.
Oh, is
so it? The problem is people go, oh, I really want to implement Zigbee. And they go, well, okay, what do you actually want to do? And then I want to talk, you know, over a serial port that's wireless to my thing. You go, oh, okay, that's the serial sub-portion of Zigbee.
Yeah.
So if you focus in on kind of a sub-portion, then you can kind of start addressing it. But if you're going to be building an ASIC, you kind of want to do more than just little point applications. And so nobody's got that next one really.
Yeah.
Because nobody knows what the subsections of Zigbee that people actually care about are. Yeah.
Yeah.
So for now, it would be easier to just use Bluetooth.
Yeah, and then you can just say, well, okay, well, someday somebody will come up with a Zigbee module and I can just swap out the Bluetooth one. And
We'll
be cursing for a few days to try and get anything to talk on Bluetooth, and then you'll realize it's even worse on Zigbee.
If all you're trying to do is get a serial port to connect wirelessly on Bluetooth, that's relatively easy because most of the stacks kind of get that right. But it's still, taking like a day or two to get.
I got really carried away and bought a quad function Bluetooth stereo headset that has a built-in microphone, a FM radio. It's got an MP3 player. It acts as a headset and as a stereo headphones. So it's got like, all these, like, it just confused everything. I spent weeks trying to make it do anything.
Yeah. Well, right, and
if a Mac, it got totally confused. It said, oh, it's a headset. Oh, it's got something else. What's that? Oh, I don't support that. And it deconfigured it. And then it said, oh, it's a headset. And it would just loop forever. Saying, I see this. This is confusing. Oh, no, I know what that is. And then it just went backwards and forwards. You could sit there clicking on the things.
So why is the radio even accessible over the Bluetooth interface? I mean,
well, it just happens to have a radio. But the only thing that reliably worked was the FM radio because it involved using the Bluetooth part. But the idea was that if a call comes in and you've got it bound to a cell phone, then it stops the radio and you get the talking.
Very good.
Similar to a little SD card with an MP3 player in it. But the microphone is sort of on the little hole in the front of the headphone, so it's not very good for ambient noise.
How much did it say you back?
It's $100. I got it on eBay direct from Hong Kong. They shipped it from Hong Kong. So.
Which version is this? Which model?
I can't remember. I blogged, sort of, I did a whole series of blog entries about how all the pain I was going through trying to make the stupid thing work, so I have to go look it up. It was about a year ago. And there are some better ones now, but I knew I was out on the leading edge, and I just felt like it.
The main issue I've run into with Bluetooth is that basically the only Bluetooth that works fairly reliably is cell phone talking to headset.
Yeah.
And the further you go away from cell phone talking to headset, more problems have. So if it's headset talking to computer, that kind of almost just about works.
You know, it's just a derivative of the serial port problem. Yeah. If it wasn't a KSR-33 talking to a 300-baud modem, you were screwed.
Exactly.
That's all it was good for.
It took me half a day removing a number of drivers to get my computer and my cell phone talking.
Yeah.
I figure it's between a day and a week per function that you're trying to get to work, and then it turned out it wasn't very stable. Even when I did get it to work, you had to kind of push all the right buttons in the right sequence.
Yeah,
so
it's like
if you push something in the wrong order, then it lost its mind.
But has anybody looked at the Bluezy stack? It's I had
about well actually ER looked about 3 or 4 minutes.
I had the unfortunate task of going through some of the Bluezy code, and it's. And that's actually when I realized that, you know, the only thing worse than the Bluezy code is the spec. So
the coolest Bluetooth thing I ever saw was the Enoto pen thing, where you just draw stuff on this special paper and it knows what you're looking
at. Was that the?
There's this magic pattern on the paper that doesn't repeat, so it can tell exactly
where
I'm at.
Is that kind
it's
of like
actually
the fly?
This kids.
Yeah, the fly,
toy,
the pen top.
Yeah. There's a kid's story now based on it.
Is it EPAD? But
it's the
Fly is the name of the kid's.
Yeah, it was some guys in Sweden years
fly
ago
paper.
That came up with it.
Fly paper.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fly paper.
Yeah. Fly pen or something, yeah. That's the kind of they finally productized into a toy, but about 10 years ago, I happened to be in Sweden and they told me to see these people with a eventually would run into a product 10 years later.
But
an extra.
Yeah.
A ladder.
But anyway, so yeah, part of what I was wanting to talk about a little bit, but was the, you know, how to build an ecosystem to support people, to support a robust design economy, so that we can, you know, ultimately what I'd love to see is you know, all of these, you know, thousands of little niches have products feeding into them that more appropriately meet, you know, the needs of those niches, and you know, divert some of the value stream away from these monolithic carriers who are building these, you know, big hit products that don't necessarily do a good job of doing anything. You know, although I must admit that if my cell phone is in range of a tower, it generally completes calls fairly well. So, I mean, I do respect the fact that it does that. But in the future, when people start, when people start talking about, you know, convergence devices, especially at Palm Source, when people have started talking about how wonderful Trios were, I just had a laugh at them. Because they really are, if you have a particular application in mind for your Trio, it tends to be relatively crappy. Unless...
Browser!
Well, the browser is relatively crappy.
I had the digital services enabled for a couple of months and then canceled them.
It's the least bad thing I've found. I can use.
The browser?
The main thing, I mean, I was trying to get here, and I've got my little Google Maps application on my Trio, and it told me to go that way instead of this way, so I spent a while driving around saying, I can't see anybody. Google thinks it's that way from
really?
Yeah,
right, yeah, you get, right, yeah, that's right.
Trio's fault.
Yeah.
I had those same directions, but they were printed out on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Still.
But you know, that was what I was using it for. It's useful. I don't have to carry around my piece of paper. When I get lost and I go off the edge of the piece of paper, right?
But the piece of paper was all broken.
Google also used to misidentify their own office. When Google Maps first came out, it used to be like Google's office used to be Silicon Valley or SGI.
Yeah.
The Silicon Graphics, and like, if you typed in Google like, address of 1600 Amphitheater Parkway, it would pop up as like Silicon Graphics.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
It's
really funny.
But yeah, there's some good uses for it. But it is, I think, it's the least bad, right? And there are still some frustrating things. I'd like to get rid of some of the applications on it I'm not using, which are built into the ROM you can't get rid of. Well,
I'll say that. And I think the email client that comes with the Trio 650 is.
Yeah, I use Chat.
Yeah, okay, there you go. I should have just. I felt some obligation to use their email application since I sat next to the guy who wrote it, and not complain so much. But
it's your fault for not complaining to him then.
Exactly.
Or maybe you did complain to
him. Oh, I did complain to him, and it finally kind of dawned on me. It's like management wasn't going to give anybody any leave to go and make any of this stuff any better. And to me that's the big issue is that. The hardware vendors, the carriers, and the software vendors are, you know, tied into this whole big hit product, which is, you know, which in mobile convergence is just pile a bunch of crap onto it, and the fact that it'll do a bunch of different things not especially well,
which is why people buy Apple shit.
Right.
I mean, everybody develops to the feature list, they get to print on the side of the box. And then they stop there, and they don't care about the polish that makes the stuff actually easier. Yeah.
Exactly.
Craftsmanship.
Or the quote-unquote experience. And so,
Steve Jobs saying, you're not shipping that until I think it's good.
Yeah.
The open source community has done the hardest job of integration.
Yeah.
And so, you know.
Because they don't have a master.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have somebody in charge who can say that.
Why would I be my own bastard about my own product so I can keep hanging on it until it does what I want it to do?
And that's just
declare it to be done. If anyone wants a copy of it, they can have it. But,
yeah, that's just it. I think that the open source tools are at a point where they're a really good starting point. You know, rather than starting from scratch, you know, you can start from, you know, familiar Linux with some bizarre version of Conqueror or something integrated into it. Like, I'd hate to see that, but it could probably be done.
I'm going to go and sort of print myself a different enclosure every couple of months.
And that's right, exactly.
That's coming. It'll be a little while.
Yeah, but we know where the 3D printer lives.
Yeah, but
we just need to go, you know what? It's a bit too thick, and I think if I rearrange the, you know,
yeah.
I go in and just print it again and wrap the bits out, stick it in again, and do open heart surgery on it. That's what I'd like to do. And if I bought myself a nice big touch screen, I want to rip out the modem and put a 3G modem or something in there one day.
Exactly, because I mean, it's like
keep the other bits.
One of the things I learned from reading the Spark Fun webpage very closely is that surface mount, building surface mount components with those components is not especially difficult.
Not if you use machines to do the actual construction.
No. Did you see Bunny Wong's?
Oh yeah, I've seen Bunny stuff. If you've got extremely good vision and manual dexterity, it's actually not that up.
No. But now go and look at the Spark Fun webpage where they talk about the surface mount griddle.
Yeah.
So basically,
mount griddle and toaster oven.
And then there's another.
We've got a lot of toaster oven stuff at Nelstics for the
Yeah.
Looks pretty well.
Yeah.
Put solder paste down, put a component on top, and it works less well with unleaded solder now, but a little leaded solder at very high surface tension, so it actually just pull all your components.
As long as you have fairly large leads, it's probably not that hard.
You actually don't even need very large leads because the surface tension pulls the component into the right position.
Well, the trouble is you get shorting and you get these, you know, the things on 20 mil centers or something.
Yeah, you just need to not put too much solder paste. That's the key.
Right. Well, but the thing is that. So the thing that I found, the Spark Fun guys, what they'll do, they've got a design shop in Nevada that'll cut your mask for you. You know, it's something like 50 cents a square inch or something obscenely cheap like that. And Mike, you were telling me, you know, some guys will do boards pretty.
AP Circuits in Canada is cheap and fast turnaround.
Okay, right. And I mean, I'm out there right now looking for a ferric chloride to like etch some of my own PCBs. And Mike was telling me, it's like, screw it, just go get, you know, let somebody else's stream get polluted.
Yeah.
And,
it's kind of like a car wash, where, you know, in theory, they're actually better at collecting all the stuff where you're going to pour it out.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly.
They're professionals.
Right.
Yeah. I have an inspector every once in a while that shows up and takes soil samples.
I mean, so it's getting, you know, painfully easy to build a lot of these devices these days. And
you find a club member who's got the equipment to do proper
brain
things. And
yeah, that's why we have all of these meetings.
Yeah, there's
down
skills here and different goals. And I used to do hardware, but I'm not going to go out and get rid of that new soldering. My eyesight's not good enough for the current pitch.
Well,
and I don't think it should be if I started putting things in the oven.
Humber Computer Club in the UK, there was a guy who designed the boards and got the bits and soldered them on, and then he helped you find where the solder splashes were, which was the important part for me.
So I'd volunteer Michael to do that, except he's here.
I did the software for it. That was my contribution.
I'm also interested in getting away from the cell phone companies, look at other radios and other technologies, whether Wi-Fi, WiMAX.
Self-configuring mesh network would be very interesting.
Yeah.
The technology in the One Laptop per Child project is already
there. That's right.
We have a number of people here in this building that are involved in that project. But one of the companies whose products are sitting out there are the prototypes for the One Laptop per Child power source.
Cool.
So I was going to take this opportunity to sort of piggyback on what you were saying, introduce Instructables and why I'm here and what sort of everyone's
doing. Tell me, what is Instructables?
I have one of your t-shirts.
Do you?
Yeah.
Excellent. We have some more somewhere.
Yeah. Jim Newton down at the tech shop has a big stack of them. made sure that we knew about you guys.
Instructables is essentially... I mean, it's basically a giant user-generated how-to site, but a good portion of our projects are, I guess you call it open source stuff. It's essentially the idea of share what you're passionate about and know how to do and let other people learn and piggyback on it. And we have a lot of communities in a lot of different areas.
LEDs are really, really popular these days. And oddly, like, one of the most popular groups in our site, these group, many of them out of the UK, are called, these bunch of kids called the Kinects Gunners, and they're building all of these really elaborate structures out of Kinects, the Lego set, the rubber bands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, it's all of us are sharing what you know and what you know how to do. And what I was going to tell you or say, I mean, one of the reasons I first contacted Matt is I thought there was a great overlap, and that we have these groups, and we have, I mean, this month is on Instructables, is actually, or I called it, I made a joke at some point, because we had a, we were doing a Learn to Solder post in Make Magazine, to, I don't know if any of you guys know, of Make and the people there, they were, we know them well and work with them, but they were doing the soldering thing. Like, I said to them, like, I made a joke, yeah, it's National Learn to Solder Month.
Yeah,
and
Eric's yeah, because on their video video log, they were doing that.
And Eric's like, oh, that's a great idea. So someone pointed up and said, like, why don't you share how to solder? So we've gotten like 30 or 40 people about how to do it and how to do these things. So, but it would say is, if you have any projects or work on this, if you post it, if you form a group and post it on the site, what you're going to get are a lot of other people that aren't here in Silicon Valley that are interested in it and can contribute and can do parts of it. Because we have people, I mean, it's not us, it's not we, but the community has hackers and tinkers from all over the country, and all over the world, particularly strong. We have a lot of people in Canada, the UK, and Australia that have been putting stuff together for years and years and years.
Yeah, so I mean, it's perfect because, you know, I'm having some pretty severe problems keeping my website up. So I have no problem having someone else's website.
We have groups, we have forums, we have the ability to host files, anything you want to put on it to make things work. We have collaborations features, so if you want to work on something with other people and documenting how you're doing it, that's what, I mean, it was started as a project with labs, basically to document all these projects they were working on. They needed some way to share knowledge internally, rather than to have, so someone tells everyone else how they're doing it. It was so they could sort of work independently, but still be working on the same thing. So I want to invite everyone to put something. It's what it's there for.
And what I would love to do is, at this meeting, is actually try to figure out who's good at what. And unfortunately, Mike Chaponis didn't make it. Mike reluctantly, kind of, almost, sort of, volunteered to do some board design for us. But I've got to make sure that I make it worth his while.
That is his business.
What?
That is his business.
Well, right, exactly. Well, right, exactly. So I mean, it's like I've got to go, and I don't have a budget to pay him anything. So I mean, I have to make sure that he got, you know, his picture on every PCB that was manufactured or something. I don't know.
or
just design the shape of the antenna.
That's
an idea.
That'd be kind of cool. So that, you know, moving forward, we can all standardize on a platform, a base level platform that, you know, may not be like 100% of what everyone wants, but it might be 90%, and then, you know, you're kind of on your own for the remaining 10%, and hopefully, you know, we'd make it kind of easy so that, you know, there's a little bit of prototyping space on one of the boards, so when you're going to go put yours together, you can just use that, and if that won't do, then you might have to redesign the board, you may have to refab it yourself. And I think, you know, ultimately, you know, Craig over at Gumsticks has, you know, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seemed to me that you were saying that there might be some interest in, like, an LCD sticks.
Yeah, so basically, we actually, what we want to do is build kits that, I mean, it's basically, if that 90% board that you're talking about, we would be happy to manufacture and sell that so that people don't have to build their own and you don't have to, you know, get the instructions and say, okay, here are the components you need, here's the PCB design, and here's the place to manufacture. Right. Instead, you just go and you just put your shopping cart.
More like a Heathkit.
Right, exactly. Yeah. More like a PC.
And then it would have that expandability option on there so that if you do say, oh, I'd really like to do Zigbee, it'll have a serial port on there or something. You can just nice, big, easy soldering wires on the side of it to connect your Zigbee module for Spring Run or whatever you want to do it from.
Yeah.
So the kind of functionality we would put on board is stuff that basically everybody's going to want. We've got a cellular module, and we've got maybe optionally populated accelerometer,
right.
GPS module, or Wi-Fi module.
Or all of them.
Exactly.
Yeah. I have yet to understand why there aren't more GPS modules. There are modules in phones, and it frustrates the hell out of me.
They're still a little large, the phones. They're getting small.
But you have eGPS, and yet you can't access it.
Yeah.
Are they combination modules that do both?
Yeah, the
guys in Florida, that module they were talking about had GPS built in.
Well, and one of the Telit modules has GPS.
Yeah, I think that was the one. Yeah. It was a Telit module.
I got the GPS on the Telit.
Oh, you did? Okay. Yeah. But, I mean, they are kind of big.
Yeah, but, I mean, that would, you can get 90% there with a GPS system if we could actually access your phone's GPS.
Right.
But you can't.
Well, right, exactly. That's right. And so,
is that accessible on from the Motorola module?
I don't know how to access.
Did you get? Is that like the second generation?
Yeah, this was the one. This was the one that didn't work.
Okay. So you just
the one that you right. need.
Okay, so you just got the new carrier.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. Let's pass one around.
Where are these boards from? Were these from Telit?
SparkFun.
Yeah, so Telit is the manufacturer.
Right.
And SparkFun.
Of
the module.
And then this is GPS antenna.
Can you pass the antenna around?
No.
Hey, what's this big SOIC down here? Well, it's not.
For recording.
Also recording.
It's got to be an active antenna.
DJ Python.
I think it's going to be active on the antenna.
Okay. Oh, cool. So you can pass it around on the box. Cool.
There are problems with those as well.
Yeah, we should probably say for the recording that hardware emerged from boxes and people just went gaga.
Main problem is broken out.
So that's the board. Both these boards are made by SparkFun, which is in Colorado.
Oh, and that's the Telit GPS.
So yeah, this is the Telit board. Right, the Telit board. And
the problem other places is like the lines.
So this one does both GPS and GSM.